When it's about 10, 12 minutes after, and I apologize for getting started late. This is June the 1st. We're in our sixth month of the Legislative Assembly. It's about 1:12 in the afternoon, and this is House Committee on Revenue. We welcome you today. We've got a number of bills to be heard, and the first one we've got set for public hearing is Senate Bill 847. And I understand that Senator Carter is on this bill as well as Representative Hansen. Representative Hansen, welcome. We're honored to have you here and appreciate you taking your time. Why don't we come forward and Representative Hansen, will you just, we've got staff coming to tell us what this bill does. Why don't you tell us what this bill does in your words?
Why don't I let staff tell you what the bill does, and then I can go to my prepared notes and not get out of sequence.
To see if you, okay. Mary?
Thank you. Butler. Senate Bill 847 will reinstate a legislation that was sunsetted a few years ago, I think in 2003. It will provide a 10-year exemption for property tax from property tax for newly constructed single-family units, owner-occupied housing units, that are located in a city's distressed area. A single unit is a single dwelling that is occupied by a single person or family. The dwelling unit may be a single-family detached housing unit or a row house or townhouse that shares common wall with other similar units or a condominium. The distressed area, designated as an area that has a significant number of vacant or abandoned structures in it but cannot exceed 20% of the total land mass of the city. A unit that's qualified for the exemption must have a market value of no more than the lesser of 120% of the city's median housing value or a percentage adopted by the city. And a distressed geographic area is defined by statute as a deteriorated residential area that is unsafe and may contain a significant number of vacant or abandoned dwellings in it. The applicants for the program may be approved or denied for the tax year beginning July 2005, and during the 10-year exemption period, owners are still obliged to pay taxes on the land. The prior legislation that sunsetted did not include provisions for condominiums, actually, and I have been told by people in Portland, for example, that like this particular piece of legislation, they have infill projects in the northeast that often will use the concept of the row houses on existing property that has a single family unit on it. So that is the content of the bill, and there is a dash one amendment that adds a sunset provision that is July 1, 2015.
Thank you very much, Mary. And the fair market value of these residences I have listed at about $170,000 with family earnings at $54,000. Is that still correct?
I do not know.
Okay. Representative Hansen, again, welcome. I understand Senator Carter may be available. We are honored to have you both, either or both. For the present time, you can go ahead and take your time and her. We've got a total of 3 minutes allocated.
Okay, thank you, Mr. thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I want to thank staff for a very comprehensive recap of what the bill does. When I was the county commissioner during the 90s, my district was composed north and northeast Portland, and we were very active in home building using the previous bill that sunsetted and expired. When I came on the commission in 1990, we had 700 tax foreclosed properties, most of which were in north and northeast Portland. They virtually could not be given away. Now those same properties are at a minimum of the vacant lots are at a minimum of $45,000. We, by using this program in connection with some of the nonprofit housing corporations, we were able to create several hundred new homes. By having this little tax relief for the first 10 years, it made very affordable and a lot of deals penciled out that low-income families could get into their first home. The homes that we were talking about building in the early and mid-90s were about $57,000, and people were getting into them for $150 a month house payments. It made affordable housing for a lot of people. Now the scales have changed. I mean, the housing prices have went up. Interest rates are probably lower now than they were at that time. But still having that increment of the tax relief where you're only paying taxes on the property and not on the improvements for the first 10 years, sometimes it's the difference between it being affordable for a family or not affordable. I don't know what all of the elements were that turned North and Northeast Portland around. There were a lot of things that went into those communities making a revival. Clearly, new affordable housing. Using this program, we were able to create the first new houses that were built in Northeast Portland in many, many years. Whether that triggered the boom, whether it was part, whether it was one component, I don't know. But I think it was real important. It gave people hope. People saw that new houses could be built in an older existing neighborhood and that people could thrive living in those places. I think it helped to create the turnaround that now has been very significant. I don't know where the next wave of places, there are certainly some places in Northeast Portland that could still benefit from this, but I'm thinking probably in the greater Portland area it'll be the older suburbs. Rockwood, maybe Gladstone, maybe Cedar Mill, that might benefit from this type of a program. But at least this is one more tool that we can put in the toolbox for both affordable housing and community renewal. At that point, I'd just like to thank you for your time, and I certainly hope you can vote yes on this bill, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Hansen. The information I had, and I think Ms. Pepori can probably respond to it, was the earnings capacity of the families and the fair market values of the home. Do you have any information on that?
No.
Okay. And the total cost would be $3.9 million for the current biennium. That would be $1.3 million for the general fund for education. Is that what I'm understanding?
Well, there's different ways to look at the cost. If a lot stays dormant and nothing's done with it, there's not a great deal of loss there. The loss is only prospective if the property is improved.
Okay.
Would be my sense of it.
Okay. So folks that have moved into the homes that have purchased and are in the process of purchasing the homes, they wouldn't be the candidates for this credit?
I'm not sure. I thought it was starting over, but Ms. Kafori can right. Certainly correct me if I'm wrong.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Hansen. Questions, Representative Kamp?
I think you have a map there. I don't see that I don't have, but I was just wondering for staff or if anybody knows, are there other distressed areas outside of the city of Portland that fall under this definition, or is it just predominantly in Portland that we're talking about?
I'm going to invite Marge to come forward for the time being. Let's go ahead and have her get her testimony. Maybe that she might have some additional. And I had received a map in visiting with Marge when I asked.
Good, and I just got a pretty color one.
Great. I don't have a color.
We can share.
Marge. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Marge Kafori, representing the City of Portland, and I think I'll just answer your questions, and then we can go to the other witnesses that are here. Representative Comp, you asked about other areas in the state that might be using
right.
this. I'm not aware of any. I think we're the only jurisdiction that's using this program now,
okay.
Which is not to say that others wouldn't be able to use it. It is a local option program, so any jurisdiction that has this issue in its community and wants to address it in this way can choose to activate the program with the approval of 51% of the taxing jurisdictions within the jurisdiction.
Thank you. Okay.
And, Mr. Chair, to your question, the limit on the house price is $170,000, and that is for the limit on income is $67,900 for a family of four.
So I qualify. And that family of four, $67,900, what is that? What percentage of federal poverty limit? 100%.
Yeah.
$67,900 for a family of four. Okay. Representative, did you have a question?
Yes, I had a question. Ms. Kafouri, how often does the City of Portland review this distressed area designation, and what's the process here?
Mr. Chair and Representative Berger, I think I'd like to ask the program manager to come up and address those questions specifically, since he would be able to tell you how frequently the city reviews the distressed area. And if I might, I have one other witness, Mr. Chair, if
thank,
I could.
Thank you again. Were there any other questions of Representative Hansen while he was here? We're honored to have you here.
I
know that you're very busy, Representative Hansen. Thank you for taking the time to share with us. Please follow up, Representative.
Yes, my name is Brian Morisky, and I'm Program Administrator from the Portland Development Commission with the Limited Tax Abatement Program. We review the distressed area map every 3 years. It's the Planning Bureau reviews that in conjunction with the Portland Development Commission and other partners.
And outside of the City of Portland, Brian?
I don't know which areas are outside the City of Portland that would be declared distressed area.
Okay. So on the periphery of Portland, there's no areas that this would qualify?
No, none that I know of.
Okay. And this is Mr. Miller?
Yes.
Mr. Miller, you're the chair of the HOAL?
HOAC. It's a Home Ownership Advisory Committee. It's a subcommittee of the Housing and Community Development Commission.
Did you have testimony, Mr. Miller?
Briefly, I understand you're on a pretty tight schedule today, so I'll just skip right to my story. Host Development, I also am executive director of Host Development, which is a nonprofit in Portland that has taken advantage of this program for several years. Back in 1995, we sold a home to a woman who we went back and checked, and without this program, she would not have been able to purchase a home. In the year 2000, she took advantage of some of the equity in her home and helped her daughters finish college. After that, her daughters actually took advantage of the program again, both of them purchasing homes in our Charleston Place development. Without this program, they would never have been able to purchase homes, and so it's been really critical for them. There's never been home ownership in the history of their family, and it's made a huge impact for that family. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Miller. Then we understand that what is happening here is that people that qualified in the past for this can come back on, even though they're qualified, even though they own their own home now, and all they have to do is just meet the federal poverty limit and the value of the home. Is that correct?
As far as I understand it, they do need to be first-time home buyers. Is that
actually, that's not the first-time homebuyer was proposed, but that's not part of the legislation.
Okay, then that is correct. And it's actually, they are at median family income within the city of Portland. 67.9 is the HUD median family income.
So if I understand correctly, I just need to know about the mechanics. A person could be living in their home, and if the home is valued at less than $170,000, I assume that's the RMV, is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, so real market value less than $170,000, and as long as they're making less than the federal poverty, 100% of the federal poverty limits, then they can just get back into the program as soon as it's passed, and that way they could immediately take advantage of reduced to zero property tax.
Mr. Chair, that's not quite my understanding of the way the program works.
I'm just grappling with the mechanics.
And I'll try to answer your questions. The abatement is on the improvements, not the land. The abatement benefits the owner. It benefits the owner for 10 years in the house that the owner purchases. If the owner stays in that house, at the end of 10 years, he or she begins to pay property taxes. If the owner moves and moves to another house that is eligible under the program, then the owner would be eligible.
And they remain eligible?
Yes.
Okay. And under the 100% of the federal poverty law or limit, if they have a gain on the sale of the home, is that examined in relationship to the total? I don't think capital gains are part of the
That's right.
calculation,
That's
are they?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
So a person could move from home to home as long as they met the federal poverty guidelines and the homes and the home, not the land, the value of the home itself, the structure itself, was less than $170,000 real market value.
It's not. It's actually the total purchase price of the home and land needs to be under $170,000.
I see.
But yeah. The abatement is just on the improvement.
It's also for new construction, and I think that's important in that they can't just move from house to house and take advantage of this if they meet the two other criteria. Mm-hmm. It's also for new construction only. So.
Oh, I see. So, so they could move into a condominium later on, a new condominium, as long as the value of that condominium unit was under $170,000, they still met the federal poverty.
As long as that condominium was initially eligible for the tax abatement when it was built.
Right.
So then what we have is that if the land was worth $70,000 and the condominium was worth $100,000, then they would have an abatement on the $100,000.
That's correct.
They would qualify
for an
abatement on the $100,000. Okay. Do they make an application? Is that how they do that, or is this so? It's person by person application.
Yes, they make application to the Portland Development Commission.
Okay, and is there outreach to these folks to let them know what the program is and some active intervention?
Quite a bit. Yeah.
Excellent. Okay, I'm sorry, I'm dominating the entire.
So what else is here, Mr. Chair? Okay.
Further questions of these folks? Thank you very much. We appreciate your information that you've provided us. If there are no further questions, let's see. I had Marge and Brian and John that signed up. We never did see the senator. I know that she was called in for me. Thank you very kindly. We appreciate your testimony. And then we do have the one proposed amendment, which is the dash one, and we discussed that briefly to reestablish a sunset back on it for 10 years. Okay. If there's no further testimony, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 847 and open a work session on 847. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 847.
The motion is to append the dash one amendment to dated 6-1 of 05 to Senate Bill 847. Is there any discussion to the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none and recognizing that Representative Boquist is excused on other House business, we will append the dash one amendment. So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 841 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. 847, I'm sorry.
The motion is to move 847, Senate Bill 847, as amended with the dash one amendment, to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion to this motion? Any objection? Hearing and seeing no objection and recognizing that we have one member, Representative Boquist, excused on House business, the Chair will order 847 to the House floor with a due pass, as amended with a due pass motion, due pass recommendation. And we would assign that to Representative Hansen. He's one of the authors of the bill. So if you can notify Representative Hansen. With that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 847. Thank you very much. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 996.
Feels like we've won.
Chairman Butler and committee members, with Senate Bill 996, this is the bill dealing with the annual cap on the amount of affordable housing tax credits that the Housing and Community Services Department can certify. And what came from the Senate out of the Senate was to certify up to $11 million per year, and that's a change from $6 million, which is the current cap. And it applies to tax years 2005 and beyond. And then you have an A2 amendment, and this is at the request of Senator Deckard, because at the time that we were dealing with this bill, he thought he already had done that in the engrossed, that we hadn't gotten that sunset extended. So that's what your A2 does, is just extends the sunset on the Affordable Housing Tax Credit out 10 years from December 31st, 2009 to December 31st, 2019. And we had quite a bit of testimony on this in support of the bill. There is a revenue impact that begins this biennium. For 2005-07 biennium, it's $959,509. It grows, and the reason why you're not getting it right, you know, this big impact from $6 million to the $11 million right away is just because of the timing. They have loans in reserve, and then you have to, after a year of being in a reserve, then you can actually get the tax credit, and it becomes, the loan becomes certified. So it's just a timing issue of this. But basically about in 2009-07 biennium at $6.9 million loss in revenue, in 2009-11 biennium $8.67 million.
Okay. Questions of staff relative to the presentation on Senate Bill 996? Let's see. We have Kevin O'Reilly, Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, my name is Kevin O'Reilly. I'm here representing the Oregon Paralyzed Veterans of America, and you have heard quite a bit of testimony on this bill previously. We do support the bill. We think that this is one of the rare opportunities I get to speak to a bill that would help citizens who, other than veterans. It would help veterans, but it'll help other citizens as well. It would help low-income disabled and low-income seniors in finding affordable, adequate housing. And this is becoming quite an issue throughout our state, I understand. I have had some small experience working with St. Vincent de Paul of Lane County. I live in Lane County, and I've worked with them in their affordable housing programs. I understand that they also offer programs to assist tenants in getting out, breaking the cycle of poverty, if you will. And these programs have been quite successful, I understand. They have been able to assist 25 families in moving up and out of the cycle of poverty, three actually into home ownership, always a good thing. And keeping it short and simple, there's an added benefit, of course, that this raising the tax credit would help leverage other dollars into the state, federal monies. And it would also, of course, helps create jobs. So there are added benefits. And if there's any questions, I can possibly answer.
Thank you, Mr. O'Reilly. Are there questions for Mr. O'Reilly? We appreciate your coming forward and testifying in this matter, Mr. O'Reilly.
You're welcome. Thank
you. And you're right. We have had considerable testimony on affordable housing tax credits in Oregon. Thank you very much. I have further... Oh, I'm sorry. Representative...
No, finish your testimony, then I have questions. Too.
Okay. I have further sign up Bill Van Vliet and Mark Nelson. Yes, you have a question, staff?
Yeah, on the A2. Okay.
The A2 to extend the...
Yes.
To 2020.
The original bill also extended.
No.
It did not extend.
Did not extend it. That's why Senator Deckard...
It just raised the cap.
Just raised the cap.
Oh. And if we do not extend...
And it dies in 2010.
It, yeah. 2010. It did die in 2010.
Yeah, and you still would have one more session to extend it if you needed to.
Right, we got the seven.
You got seven.
Thank you. Mr. Van Vliet, Mr. Nelson.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing the Housing Alliance. As has been indicated, there has been considerable testimony, I think came before you in the form of House Bill 2775, which, of course, is a mirror of this bill. And I want to introduce today Bill Van Vliet, who's the Executive Director of the Network for Affordable Housing. We'll be very brief and see if you have any questions since the last time we made this presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Bill Van Vliet, Executive Director of NOAA, the Network for Oregon Affordable Housing, a multi-bank nonprofit loan consortia. Finances a lot of affordable housing projects around the state. we're one of the primary users of the OAHTC program in the state each year. And I'll be very brief. I've testified before. I won't take too much of your time, but I just want to reemphasize that this is a very, very important program to providing affordable housing for low-income Oregonians. All the benefit goes to the tenants. None of it goes with the banks. None of it stays with the developers. It allows households to be able to afford housing and other basic necessities and not have to make those very difficult choices between housing and food, medicine, or heat. And it also generates a tremendous amount of leverage of private sector investment in affordable housing projects statewide. Not just, those are the key points, I think, the strengths of the program. And with that, we'll just answer any questions.
Yes, Representative Berger.
How long have we had this particular program?
The program came in the early 90s, I believe, okay, is my memory.
So we have a 10-year history.
Absolutely.
Okay. Yeah, my only concern.
Mr. Van Vliet, I just a series of questions. I had a constituent write me regarding some concerns. Oregon's percentage of residential home ownership in comparison to other Western states, do we know what that is?
It's with regards to other Western states, I can't speak to that precisely. I think we have the ninth worst in the nation.
And that was the information. He didn't give me the actual percentage of where we are, but this is back from one of my constituents in Eastern Oregon, mm-hmm, where they're comparing Idaho with 75% home ownership amongst Idaho residents. Do you have any idea where Oregon falls in percentage in terms of home ownership?
I believe we're in the high 60s, is my memory.
Okay.
Considerably lower.
Is there anyone within your organization or within the bankers that is trying to determine what are the driving forces and driving factors behind that? You might see where I'm going with this.
There are a lot of people that are very interested in working on home ownership issues. My organization deals strictly with rental housing, so I'm not as well versed in those. But if you want more information on that, I know there's a lot of people I can ask and provide answers for.
So, Bill, you and your organization, you deal with rental housing and still receive the credit for rental housing because it is subsidized housing for those persons that qualify for that housing.
Correct.
Are the credits mainly used by banks?
Exclusively.
Okay. But I guess the concern of my constituent goes on to try and elicit is, what are we doing to define what causes Oregon's very low participation in the home ownership markets? Are we just going to continue to offer credits? Or are we going to try on the backs of the rest of taxpayers? We're going to try and define what it is to make sure that we can make more affordable housing in the process.
Mr. Chair, again, our focus here, of course, has been just on the rental housing and this particular credit, which applies for that. I believe the department has data as it relates to the home ownership percentage and can respond to the various programs that are out there to try to increase that that percentage.
Do we have anyone here from housing? Yeah, we do have there in the back. I wonder, are you prepared to respond to some of that from the rostrum up here? Well, this may be an excellent program, but the concern from my constituents is Oregon continues to go downhill and wonders where we're at and what we're doing to actually make a difference in the market.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Rick Krager, Chief Financial Officer for Oregon Housing Community Services. The department does have a variety of home ownership assistance programs as well as the residential loan program, the issuance of tax-exempt bonds. We, in terms of your question related to the data, I need to go back and verify, but I want to say in terms of where Oregon ranks in terms of the rest of the Western states, we're around 60, I want to say between 66 and 68%, but I need to verify that, and I'll make sure to do that and get back to you. Our programs, we have a variety of different ones that go specifically for the first-time home buyer that are low-income in nature. So we do, you know, have a variety that will assist the low-income
people. And the OAHTC does qualify for both the rental housing as well as the homeowner purchase outright ownership?
No, Mr. Chair, this is Mark Nelson again. This tax credit is only for rental housing, and it basically works that a bank would normally make a permanent loan for a housing development, say at 7.25%, makes it now at 3.25%. And that 4% is a tax credit to the bank. And in turn, those savings are passed directly in the form of lower rents to the people who are renting those projects. And so it's the entire 4% goes to reduce the rent. And that's what opens up so many more units
For rental. Right.
But it's all exclusively rental. It has nothing to do with homeownership.
All right. Okay. That exhausts the questions. Actually, there's full two pages of them. But basically, the concern is, what are we doing to make sure that these people, that we don't just provide credits for organizations and banks and other folks to lend on affordable housing for rentals, and that we not try and subsidize repeatedly the lack of ownership? Why don't we see if we can't enhance the number of units that are on the market? Of course, that's I remember from my first session here, Representative Leslie Lewis doing a quick analysis, a down and dirty analysis from the podium, and basically came up with the fact that our land use costs run the price of an average lot. We heard today in Salem or in Portland that in a distressed part of the city that they're attempting to regentrify, that the lot could be $45,000 in a very distressed situation. Whereas if you could make more lots available under area land use planning, the thought was that the price should be less expensive than that. Thank you very much. Are there questions that Representative?
Yes, I think one thing that we've done a substantial amount of surveys and things of this nature in West Medford, which is the economically challenged neighborhood within the city of Medford. The one thing that's surprising, though, some people just don't want to own a house. Period. They don't want that responsibility, nor do they want to embark upon that avenue. As for affordable housing, it's a great concern of mine. Last month in West Medford, which is the challenged part of town, the average house was $232,000. Well, that to me is not very affordable. You go up the road nationally, it's $436,000. What is affordable at that point? But I think the only way we can really work on that is to set up a trust to where, not a land trust, but a trust itself, where we can take this money and, first of all, get the government out of it. Second of all, start it with seed money. Third thing you do is you have a trust to where you buy homes, you renovate them, sell them to low-income people with a criteria, let the trust have the first deed of trust and carry the paper, so they'll be getting the monies in for the, so it'll be perpetuating itself and redoing itself with more monies, but more importantly, have a 10-year investment in it. So where the first year, if you flip the house, you get 10% of the net income, and on up to a 10-year vesting to where you get 100%. But more importantly, in the trust itself, in the deed, you have a stipulation that the trust has the first right of refusal. So therefore, the trust will remain perpetual, and eventually you'll be able to get out of the market of subsidizing from the government and having a trust with a board of directors stand on its own within a community.
Where's your green sheet?
Yeah. It'd be a good piece of legislation, wouldn't it?
I've been thinking about it.
Further question of this panel? Thank you very much. Thank you, gentlemen. Appreciate it. Thank you, Rick, for coming forward and helping us out there. I have no further folks signed up on this particular Senate bill. So we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 996 and open a work session on Senate Bill 996. Representative Berger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I would move the -2A2 amendments to Senate Bill 996. I think that we do need to extend this sunset on this program. To my motion, it has a good enough history. We know it works. the very issues that we were talking about with regard to the price of home ownership speaks to the fact that people have to have a place that's affordable to live while they save up enough money to maybe make some little down payment on a home. And that's what this program speaks to.
And it does make a direct credit to the rent.
Yes. So 4%. I'm in this long speech, I'm moving the dash A2.
The motion is to move the A2 amendment to Senate Bill 996 as previously A engrossed. That the date of that amendment is 4/25/05. Is there further discussion to the motion to move the A2 amendments? That would move this sunset out to the year 2020. Is there any objection to moving the A2 amendment? Hearing and seeing none and recognizing Representative Boquist is excused on housing business, we will append the A2 to Senate Bill 996. Representative Boquist? Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 996 as A2 engrossed to the bill with the floor of the due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move 996 as A2 engrossed today to the House floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion to the motion? Any objection to the motion? Hearing and seeing none, and recognizing Representative Boquist is excused on House business. We will order Senate Bill 996 as A2 engrossed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger, you will carry that then to the House floor. Thank you. We will close the work session on 996. We'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 31. Elizabeth?
Chairman Butler and committee members, with Senate Bill 31, this is a Department of Revenue bill that has several amendments and stuff. So the original bill just extends the Department of Revenue's authority to bring a lawsuit against any officer or employee who may be liable for not withholding personal income taxes from employees' wages. It grants the Oregon Tax Court the authority to determine if additional individuals are liable for unpaid withholding taxes during the court appeal proceedings without being confined to an earlier determination by the Department of Revenue. So this was just really an oversight the Department of Revenue found as far as the court proceedings and them not being bound by a determination when maybe they didn't have all the information. So it applies to appeals taken to the Oregon Tax Court after the effective date of this 2005 Act. Okay, so now the amendments. I gave you just a summary SMS for staff measure summary for the four amendments, but I gave you revenue impacts for each one of the four amendments. Maybe I'll just go through the 6 and the 7 and the 9 and then leave the 8 because that's one that Paul has been working on with Senator Morris. So the Dash 6 amendment provides a corporate sales tax throwback exemption for sales that are shipped from a public warehouse. It defines public warehouse. It allows the Department of Revenue the ability to determine if a warehouse meets the definition of public warehouse and it is not just being used for tax avoidance purposes. It applies to tax years beginning January 1st, 2006. So basically what we have under current law, for those of you who remember orientation, which was months ago now, but we have those sales that are thrown back. And basically what happens is if you are you do not have nexus in another U.S. state, then those sales to that destination state can be thrown back to Oregon. And also if those sales are going to, like, the federal government, a non-exempt entity. So basically we have this rule in law that corporate sales can be thrown back. And remember, we're now becoming more heavily dependent on the sales factor in our corporate apportionment formula. We'll be going to 100% by 2008. So basically what this is doing is it has an exemption if you go through these public warehouses. That's what the Dash 6 is. And basically saying a public warehouse, you can't own these goods that are going through the warehouse. That's part of the things that the advocates of this amendment want, is they want to be able to make businesses use this public warehouse and make it more attractive by having this type of exemption then for those sales throwback. Now, just so everyone's clear, how we report our sales throwback is through our corporate, on our corporate tax return, but it is a voluntary box that they check that these are corporate sales that are being thrown back from another state, and then they report the quantity of those sales. So we do have some amounts as far as annually we're seeing the amount that's reported in corporate throwback sales is total amount is about $3.3 million, assuming an 80% sales factor corporate apportionment formula, and it goes up to about $4 million if you're assuming 100% sales corporate apportionment formula. So basically, we know that's kind of the what's being reported if you assume that that's all there is in sales that are being thrown back, which, again, is a voluntary reporting, then that kind of gives you an understanding of the parameter of some of these amendments. So with the Dash 6, though, this is it is, you know, making it such that you would have to, you couldn't just be a wholesaler who created a public warehouse for just tax avoidance purposes. You would have to use an existing public warehouse or have some other reason for creating this entity of a public warehouse.
So this basically invites to a public warehouse in Oregon consignment sales from another state for distribution in Oregon.
No, distribution anywhere. It would have to be outside.
Distribution anywhere.
So then those sales would be thrown back to Oregon, and that would be the advantage. The only reason they would go to a public warehouse is not just to avoid the sales throwback tax, but it's you know, the idea that that could be one of the enhancements and one of the things that the public warehouse could be selling as far as getting new customers is if they are being hit with a sales throwback, then they could say that if you go through our public warehouse, then you don't have to be subject to that.
Okay.
So basically, as far as this Dash 6, it seems to be that providing the Department of Revenue can to define some rules that will eliminate kind of any avoidance by companies to just set up public warehouses. Then the corporate tax loss could be pretty small, less than $50,000 minimal each year.
Mr. Chair.
All right, and let's do this one at a time. So Representative, on the Dash 6 amendment?
Yeah, it's as you mentioned, January was quite a while ago. Could you define throwback for me one more time?
Okay, so you say you have a company, and the one company that has been, you know, discussing this is they were worried about sales being throwback. Say they come and they set up a warehouse here in Oregon, and then they have sales in Washington State. If they do not have Nexus in Washington State, those sales would get thrown back to Oregon. Okay, and that's what they were worried about, was having those sales thrown back to Oregon. We would then that becomes part of their tax base for the state of Oregon. So you still, even though those sales are thrown back, then you still apportion to Oregon based on the amount of sales, property, and payroll that they have.
Let me see if I say it in my words and it comes out the same. if the company we're talking about in Washington stores goods in Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody in Oregon owns those goods. Okay, and then they're sold somewhere other than Oregon. Mm-hmm. And the concern is that the sales would be credited as Oregon income.
Yeah, they become part of the income base. Sales, remember, you have sales, property, and payroll as the basis for the income of a corporation. And so sales are dependent on the sales here in Oregon, as well as if you are selling and your destination is in a state that this company doesn't have nexus in, and that state is not taxing those sales. Okay, so there has to be the criteria that they're either they don't have a corporate income tax or they...
So where do the taxes get paid?
I'm sorry?
Where do the sales attributed to in this case? Washington?
No, Washington doesn't have an corporate income tax. Right. So they could get thrown back to Oregon,
okay,
providing that company does not have nexus in the state of Washington. Okay, so there is kind of this loophole in our law in the sense that if they cannot have nexus in that other state, nexus is the key element there.
And maybe we could invite Bob Russell and Gary Eichmann to come forward. They're signed up to testify, and their story is a real life case of the 1868 company at Portland Hack and Gray. Welcome, Gary. Welcome, Bob.
Chair, thank you. Ready? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell. I'm president of the Oregon Trucking Associations, and we're here in support of the Dash 6 amendments. With me today is Gary Eichmann, president of Oregon Transfer Company, a large public warehousing firm in the Portland area, and it's Gary's real-life experience that led to the Dash 6 amendments. So I'll let Gary explain to you the problem.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Gary Eichmann. I'm a present steward of Oregon Transfer Company since it dates back to 1868. It's just my turn right now. We are one of those public warehouses that we've been discussing. We were founded, as you suggested, in 1868. Just for the record, that was the year that Ulysses S. Grant was elected president of the United States, and 1 year before the first transcontinental railroad was completed. We've been around for a while. We are a public warehouse, sometimes also known as a third-party logistics service company, and we are primarily in the food and beverage and grocery distribution business. Our service area is all of Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Western Montana, and increasingly we are also serving Northern California and Nevada. We've already kind of discussed what public warehousing is about. Basically, we're a for-hire company. We don't own any of the products that we store or distribute. It's owned by the manufacturer. Well, it is in our care and custody. And so we are, for lack of a better term, a forward warehouse for the manufacturers that we do business with. The throwback tax issue came to my attention, and I've been in this business for nearly 30 years now, just recently, when we have a very large potential company, manufacturing company from the state of Washington, who wants to use the services of Oregon Transfer and the Oregon transportation infrastructure that we have here. Until their tax folks back in Connecticut got wind of it and started looking at it, and the throwback tax then became an issue. The potential company is very large by our and Pacific Northwest standards. It's a 180,000-foot piece of business, which would occupy space in two of our distribution warehouses. And typically, we employ one warehouse-related job for every 10,000 feet. So we're talking about maybe as many as 18 full-time Teamster jobs that are at risk here. The potential client, by warehousing in Oregon, would in fact establish nexus, and they are estimating that nexus would result in $200,000 to $400,000 of new Oregon income tax just because of the nexus, and Oregon Transfer would probably pay another $50,000 or thereabouts of state income tax related to this new business. So there are jobs and potential revenue, new revenue for the state that we're looking at here, and also would be a new economic tool to help attract business to the state of Oregon as well. I'd be happy to try to answer questions.
Thank you very much, Gary. Questions? Representative Riley, is that responsive to your concern?
To some degree. I have a little problem with, I guess, just the terminology, but the way I understand what's going on in this particular case, because they established a nexus in Oregon with the warehouse, they are creating, they are going to be then paying income tax on that, or corporate tax on that, on those sales. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, that is absolutely correct. They would be paying additional income tax.
Okay.
The issue is the throwback tax, and it primarily has to do with sales from the Oregon warehouse to the state of Washington and Nevada, which do not have income taxes. Because they don't have income taxes, Oregon's throwback rule brings that revenue back to Oregon to be taxed as under Oregon's income tax. So what we're asking for is not an exemption from income tax, but only an exemption from the throwback tax
from and that throwback tax is occasioned by the distribution of consigned inventory to other places.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
I see.
And this is one of those, but for this, then they probably wouldn't come.
That is correct.
Basically what you're telling us.
That is correct.
Thank you. Representative, Representative Hass.
Question that Elizabeth maybe for the department. What was, does anyone know the original policy reason for having that throwback tax in these kinds of circumstances when other states don't have an income tax?
Well, Chairman Butler, Representative Hass, I think it's just because those sales would go untaxed. I mean, basically, they're not being taxed in that state which their destination is. So they go back to the state of origin.
So we would, I mean, if Washington changed their tax code
correct
next year, and we wouldn't be able to collect those taxes.
That's right.
Riffin Burr?
Yes, but we aren't the state of origin in these cases. The state of origin is somewhere else. We're the state of warehouse.
But they're where they're shipped from. That's
yeah.
And that's mm-hmm. and that's what's happening here is that but for the fact that we've got 180,000 square feet of warehouse space available in the state of Oregon, there otherwise would go unused by these particular firms. This gives them an opportunity to go ahead and use that warehouse space in Oregon, which creates more jobs, which creates more income, $50,000 more in income tax collections directly from the drayage company or from the transfer company, Oregon Transfer, and then gives us an opportunity to expand the job base in Portland as well.
Mr. Chair, I have one more.
Yes, Representative Riley is recognized.
What about companies that are Oregon companies? Does this do anything for companies that are Oregon companies and use public warehouses in Oregon and sell to other states?
My understanding, Representative Riley, is that they've already have nexus here in the state, and so they're taxed appropriately.
Well, but there is a throwback. Does this exempt those throwbacks?
Representative Riley, it would exempt any throwback where they're using that public warehouse.
So the answer is yes.
Yes. I mean, anyone that's going to go through the public warehouse and then they're going to go to a state where they don't have, you know, nexus, they don't have an income tax on corporations, then that will not get thrown back.
So if I may follow up.
Please, Representative.
So what you're saying is that if a company has their own warehouse in Salem, mm-hmm. okay, and the company resides here, and they use this gentleman's warehouse instead of their own, mm-hmm. they no longer have to pay the corporate taxes.
Those throwback sales.
Right. Exactly. The ones they pay now.
Mr. Chairman, can I respond to that?
It's a little different than my
right.
understanding.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Riley, there's a provision. It's the sub 7 on page 7. It starts on line 23. And what you're describing to me is an intent to avoid taxes. Mm-hmm. And that provision gives the department to deal with just that situation, and that's why we wrote it into the amendment.
Well, I don't think this is it. I think if you just had a warehouse and then you still contracted with him, you're still using a public warehouse. But if he tried to legally change his warehouse and then make it such that it was redefined as a public warehouse, then I think that's one that might fall under Department of Revenue's rule. But not if you contracted with him. He's clearly a legitimate public warehouser.
So they can quit using their warehouse?
Yes.
We need some more amendments in here.
That's not my understanding of what it is that we're intending to do here. Deborah, did you have something specific on this particular issue, this point? Okay, we'll get back with you in just a moment here on that. But it was my understanding that you could not anoint your sales for an Oregon-based company to become not subject to the throwback under this particular amendment.
That may be the understanding, but I don't read it that way.
Okay. Okay, please come forward. You have absolute latitude to change your mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. Mr. Chairman, I believe I would agree with Lizbeth's analysis of this, that what we were looking at with the tax avoidance language was a corporation that uses their own warehouse now and somehow attempts to turn that into a public warehouse to qualify under this provision. But as it was described, if I choose to contract with this gentleman to use his warehouse as an Oregon company, the sales then that are going to states that don't have jurisdiction to tax me would be thrown back and be counted as Oregon sales in that formula. So if that's not the desired intent, I do think that there would need to be some modification.
So, Deborah, what you're telling me is that an Oregon corporation who uses a public warehouse facility and basically consigns that to the public warehouse facility then avoids the sales apportionment factor the way this is thrown in here?
Mr. Chairman, again, what you're doing is calculating the apportionment factor. You're determining what Oregon sales are. And if you are selling into a state that does not have jurisdiction to tax that corporation, then those sales are thrown back and counted as Oregon sales and figuring out the apportionment formula.
But only from their own warehouse. If we're from a public warehouse, then...
Under this amendment, if they are shipping those goods from a public warehouse, those would not be counted as Oregon sales. And as Representative Riley noted, they would not be counted as any sale in any state for purposes of the apportionment.
But then what they'd have is they'd have the apportionment based upon their nexus. That would be the wages that they pay and the property that they own, which would then be 100% of everything, and then the allocation would come through that portion of the apportionment.
Mr. Chair, what you have is the potential for less than 100% apportionment of income.
Okay.
If you go back to the, I think the question was asked is what's the background on this? What were they trying to do in the beginning? The idea was that where you have state corporations operating in a number of states, how do you divide up the income? And what they looked at were those factors, sales property, and payroll. And the idea behind the throwback rule was that if you're not counting them as sales in another state, you should count them as sales from the place that they were shipped so that you get 100%. If you don't count them in any state, then you end up with less than 100% of the income being subject to tax. Not that 100% is actually taxed.
But then an Oregon-based company with 100% of its, let's just assume for the purpose of this discussion, 100% payroll in Oregon, 100% property in Oregon, then they based upon the wild and crazy formula that we've got here, they move everything to a public transfer and storage, and then it's distributed out of there by consignment, then 100% of their sales equals zero. 100% of everything else that they would be paying tax on is the payroll and the property, which they would pay then based upon that apportionment of times the total of their net income, their net corporate income, which would basically still be 100%, wouldn't it?
Well, Mr. Chair, I think as staff pointed out, when you move in 2008 to using only the sales factor,
okay,
your property will be zero, your
zero,
payroll
zero.
Will be zero, and if all of your goods are being shipped from a public warehouse,
then your tax base in Oregon will be zero.
Your tax base is zero, and income coming to Oregon is zero.
Okay, and then the cure to this, with regard to this, it doesn't. And I'm looking at the -7 too. That the department has. The department does. -7 is the targeted high access distribution centers in Oregon. From Senator Starr, the concern I've got is that isn't there an attempt to avoid tax? By using, isn't that precluded in this? It is?
Chairman Butler, can you rephrase that?
Isn't the attempt to avoid tax by using a public distribution warehouse a prohibited transaction under this?
Not using it. I mean, I think, you know, he wants you to use it, right? He wants businesses to use his public warehouse.
But an Oregon-based business.
Yeah, but what you're saying is a tax avoidance. If you take your warehouse and you try to legally convert it to a public warehouse, that's what we were trying to get at. I mean, at least get at that component of, you know, potential.
And this doesn't get to the fact that these are Oregon-based businesses that would attempt to do that then?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
Looks like we've got some more work to do, Brown.
I agree.
I appreciate you bringing that forward. Do we have, Deborah, with regard to the Dash 7, Deborah and Elizabeth, the Dash 7 is that targeted high access distribution center using the ports in Oregon. That has got the same defect in it, doesn't it?
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. And even Chairman Butler, we probably need to really bring in the targeted high access distribution center, because it doesn't even have that provision in there about the tax avoidance. That, again, is it just for the warehouses that are public warehouses. So if you want that concept extended there, then you need that.
And again, I'm looking at that, and it says it's not to be used for tax avoidance purposes in that process. I thought that meant that an Oregon-based company could not utilize this, but if it's going to allow Oregon-based companies to come in and use the transfer and storage facilities, then that may be a different issue. Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it, Mr. Eichmann. Thank you, Bob. Thank you, Deborah. It looks like then the 6 and 7 amendments will have to be reworked. Colleagues, thank you very much, Representative Riley, for that spirited discussion. And we'll move on to the Dash 8, if you could.
Senator Morris.
Yes, let's invite them to come forward. I apologize. I'm just trying to still gather the 6s and 7s out of the way here. Welcome, Senators Johnson and Morris. Thank you very much for coming. We're on the 31-8.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Frank Morris, State Senator from Albany, Corvallis. Thank you for the opportunity and colleagues to address this issue of what is called the University Venture Development Funds. My colleague, Senator Johnson, and I have been working on this, as well as your chair, and we're pleased to have this opportunity to advance this concept as an amendment to Senate Bill 31. I might just address very briefly the why and then the what. Why have this bill? And I think if you look at the data that's supplied by the Treasurer's Office and looking at the Oregon Growth Account, and the nature of those venture funds that are within that Oregon Growth Account, you look at the one that is designed to accelerate the commercialization of concepts and ideas, and it's the Northwest Technology Ventures. And the Oregon Growth Account commitment is $14 million. There's still $10.8 million of unfunded commitments in that fund. So what we have today in our university systems is we are generating intellectual properties, technology, and concepts and ideas that are begging for a way to commercialize and prove, go through what is called the proof of concept, or many people in the venture capital field call it the valley of death, because it's the highest risk. But yet while you have many great concepts, typical venture capital funds will not fund at that level until you have a proof of concept taken from the research, put on a bench scale and tested and determined if in fact there are commercial applications. So it's a critical gap in capitalizing on the inventions and the technology that are emerging from Oregon Health Sciences University and within the Oregon University system. And that's why this bill has arisen, is to provide funding for that proof of concept, that very earliest stage. It's interesting, I was visiting with a professor from Oregon State University, and he had been responsible for bringing in $40 million in grants. And he said, I've got a bundle of ideas that I know have commercialization, but I can't get them moving. And that's really what we're talking about, is taking the intellectual capital that we have in our university systems and providing the seed money for this valley of death that would allow us then to commercialize and bring forward into enterprises. The what of the bill is a bit unique in that it integrates the disciplines within the university system. It integrates the foundations, which would be responsible for raising the funds, and it integrates the schools of business, which provide the entrepreneurial education component. It integrates the schools of law, in the case of the University of Oregon. Integrates the schools of science, medicine, engineering, and technologies into capitalizing on whatever ideas that may emerge. The fund is capped at $10 million for OUS, and it's capitalized at $4 million for OHSU. Now, the way that this, the attraction for donors is a tax credit. The tax credit is provided up to 60% of the donation, and it's taken at 20% per year for 3 years. The maximum is $50,000 per individual. The unique thing about this tax credit is that it automatically sunsets, in that there's a tax credit recapture with 20% of the revenues that would be coming back to the universities. 20% of that revenue stream from the invention comes back to the Oregon Treasury until the tax credit is recaptured. So in essence, what this bill is, it's a financing timing issue where we are funding the capital through tax credits to be recaptured when the invention is generating revenue back to the university. Oregon State's history with patented, and I apologize for not having the data for the rest of the universities, but their experience is 71% of their patents that have been issued to Oregon State University are generating revenue back to the university. So while the revenue and the tax effect is somewhat indeterminate, this whole issue really stems around our faith in the intellectual capital that we have in our university system to generate commercial ideas and concepts. Do we have faith in what they're doing? And clearly, in my mind, we have an untapped resource that this bill would accelerate. So would defer to my colleague, Senator Johnson, to add additional comments or take questions.
Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Johnson, State Senator in District 16. I'm here staffing Senator Morris. I have nothing more to add.
Tell me how this, in your manner of thinking, how this would work with the existing facilities at the Oregon State University campus, Senator. What would be the outreach to the folks that would be seeking the credit, and then the selection of the projects to provide the venture capital?
Mr. Chair, colleagues, the foundation is the point of beginning for this whole enterprise.
So it's the Oregon State University Foundation.
It's the Oregon State University Foundation.
Or the University of Oregon Foundation.
Whatever that foundation is. Okay. They are the ones that will be out generating the revenue. One thing that I didn't mention I think has a very real tangible impact on the recruitment of not only students but of faculty. When they realize that there is a fund, an ability to capitalize on what they have worked on very diligently, because, as you know, we have provided them an opportunity for a share of the income that would come from this commercialization. So it's a recruitment issue for faculty, it's also a recruitment issue for the brightest and best students that are generating this technology.
Mr. Chair, I might add that one of the attractions of this bill is that the universities have the mechanisms in place to do this kind of outreach. In the interest of full disclosure, I've had the privilege of serving on the OHSU Foundation for a number of years, and they have research departments, they have very aggressive mailing lists, they have national, if not international, contacts, and I know that only from my direct experience and my service on that board, but I am positive that the University of Oregon, Oregon State, Eastern, wherever the universities are that have the complementary foundations, that the level of sophistication in those complementary foundations already exists, and rather than taking a blank piece of paper and creating a new outreach mechanism, you have very sophisticated fundraisers that I believe are eager to participate in this new product in their menu of attempts to seal donors to the institutions. I think this will present a unique opportunity for donors and a different offering in that menu of cultivation initiatives used by the university foundations.
So they could really target the target the donors that you're looking for then at the university level?
Absolutely. The manipulation of the lists is done at a very high level of sophistication, and I think it presents a complementary opportunity to not only have donors realize the benefits from this kind of a mechanism, but also to renew their philanthropic relationship with our fine institutions that rely very heavily on donors and alumni and past faculty and all of the different universe of folks who would traditionally support these kinds of foundations. So this is simply another tool.
Representative Galizio.
Here's a couple questions.
Please.
One is, Senator Morris, you mentioned that it could help us get faculty or for faculty recruitment. Isn't it currently where either the OUS system as a whole or the individual university contracts out with the faculty in terms of what percentage or the, you know, in terms of intellectual property, how the individual professor or researchers, how they benefit? Is that university by university, or is that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I don't know the specifics of how those royalties accrue back to the professors, and I can't speak to the specific amounts.
Okay. So
follow up, Representative.
So I guess then my question, well, just thinking out loud, then I'm not sure how that would then lead to recruitment of faculty, especially considering where Oregon is in terms of paying faculty versus other research universities, in, at least in the western states and actually throughout the United States. So I guess I don't really understand how it would.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think the point I was trying to make is that I think it would be an incentive for faculty if they know that, in fact, there is a fund they could tap to move their intellectual property from, you know, a concept to proof of concept. And have a funds of tap, that would be an incentive in recruitment and retainage of professors.
I can, Mr. Chair,
please,
with your permission, I can validate that from an OHSU experience. OHSU does this modestly with university funds now to help researchers cross this valley of death. And I know, although I'm not completely up to date, that they were working with a research scientist at OHSU who was looking at some drugs that had proven efficacious with breast cancer. And the question then was, how do we take it from the petri dish to some place where a venture capitalist might be willing to make an investment? And the university has had some very modest funds out of their base operating money available to bridge that gap. This would be a more institutionalized, predictable source of these kinds of funds. And I share my colleague's observation that were a scientist or a clinician who was doing research knowledgeable about the potential of taking a discovery from the petri dish to a point in its life cycle where it was desirable to a venture capitalist, that would be quite an incentive to have them not only aggressively pursue research but stay associated with the university.
One more?
Yes, please, Representative Galizia.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for that. What is the origin of the 20% of the income would go to the general fund? Why 20%? How did that come about?
That's a good question, Mr. Chair, Representative, colleagues. It mirrors the Oregon Cultural Trust. And if you analyze that from a standpoint of the federal deduction and then the Oregon tax credit, it becomes a very attractive way to raise funds. We're raising monies essentially at the benefit of the U.S. Treasury, but we have a recapture to the Oregon Treasury. And so we just settled in on that. It was an existing tax credit formula, and we said, well, let's apply it here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Riley is recognized.
Yeah, just one quick question, if either of you know the answer to this. What's the typical percentage back to the university of inventions or that sort of thing, and for how long once it goes out?
You know that?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to half answer your question because I only know half the answer. It has not been all that long that the legislature has afforded universities the opportunity to recapture any of their intellectual capital. We have just in my term in the legislature made it possible for the institutions to own equity, right. And I think that this is yet another step on the continuum towards keeping some of the profits, for lack of a better word, from these intellectual discoveries in Oregon. And so while I cannot answer your piece about what historical revenue streams have looked like, I can tell you that at one time they didn't exist at all.
Right.
And when I think of Brian Druker's work in leukemia up at OHSU, and the fact that you see the ads with them, and now he's out of my mind, the bicycle.
Lance Armstrong?
Thank you. I don't wear spandex, I can't remember his name. When I see these advertisements with Lance Armstrong, really resurrected from the jaws of death by drugs that were developed at OHSU, and it's the big national drug companies that are taking credit for these discoveries that were discovered by a fellow who's been in this building. That's simply remarkable, and we have not provided our institutions with the tools to cash in on the intellectual property that's developed inside those institutions. So while I cannot give you numbers looking back historically, I can tell you that absent these kinds of vehicles, we're missing out on a tremendous opportunity to not only grow the inventions here, but to keep the inventions here, and to have the citizens of the state profit from the financial rewards of our scientists and clinicians.
And that's our goal. Thank you.
Senator Johnson, could we use any of the Eastern universities who have had these opportunities in the past as perhaps a template of what mm-hmm. Oregon might become?
Mr. Chair, coming from you, I don't know whether Eastern means Ontario or it means MIT.
MIT, Harvard, Yale, any of those Ivy Leagues.
Mr. Chair, respectfully, I think the East Coast has given us a template for how to build jaw-dropping endowments from a variety of sources, and I think we here on the West Coast are playing catch-up ball, and with the fine work that Senator Morris has done that I'm happy to be here in full support of, I think we add the capacity to begin to capitalize the same way that the major institutions in the East Coast have shown us the way.
Thank you very much, Senator. Colleagues, this Dash 8 amendment is a replication of Senate Bill 853, which is on the Senate side. There's some angst over the fact that this is yet another credit that will have to be administered. In this particular case, the institutions would be the universities in part that would administer the credit and with the assistance of the Department of Revenue for those folks that have the credits that could inure to their benefit for this for these kinds of funds at the university system. So, and we do have the fiscal here, or the revenue impact is reflected in the work that is attached also to Senator 853. Further questions of Senators Johnson or Morris? Thank you very much. Yes, I beg your pardon. Representative Hess.
Thanks. I may be going way afield here, but you're familiar with the venture capital fund that exists today. In any way, do you see this working in concert, or is this a place where that can be scaled back or perhaps modified in any way?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hess, this is the step two. This fund becomes the step two. It doesn't replace.
Right, I understand.
Yeah. And these are grants as opposed to investments. So does that address your question?
Yes, I just know that I think Senator Johnson shares my angst over that particular lack of results in that fund so far over the last, I don't know, 7 or 8 years or since the intersection. I don't know that it's even returned any net investment results. And
who administers that fund, Leo? What?
Is it OUS?
Well, the treasurer.
Treasurer.
Yes. You're talking about the Oregon Growth Account, I believe.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
That, Mr. Chair and Representative Hess, has gone through a number of iterations over its life with a varying bag of results. I know that you and I have had many conversations about it. One of the intriguing aspects of this amendment and this concept is that it is professionally administered in a structure that already exists and is a transparent structure. These are very sophisticated fundraisers that I think have the opportunity to reach out to exactly the kind of folks that would like the structure of the complementary foundations operating in concert with the universities. I have been very concerned about the return rate on some of the funds that you and I have discussed. I see this as complementary to the idea of encouraging venture capital, but at no other point touching the other venture capital.
Thank you.
Thank you. Again, Senators, we know that you're busy with the Ways and Means process. Thank you for taking the time, and I commend you, Senator Morris and Senator Johnson, for working on Senator 853, and we'll continue to work with the Ash 8 Amendment to see what we can incorporate into Senate Bill 31. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Relative to the Dash 9 amendment, and Senator Johnson, you were on the Dash 9 as it was last session, I believe. I believe you and I were also on the Dash 9, which was the 2003 Senate Bill 362.
I recall the Senate bill. I'm at the disadvantage. I do not have the Dash 9s in front of me, Mr. Chair. I came in to work on the Dash 8s, and that's okay. All I was prepared to talk about.
The Dash 9, for the benefit, while we're having some staff get those for you and Senator Morris, Dash 9 is from Senator Deckard's 2003 Senate Bill 362, when we threw Senator Deckard under the bus, and his 362 passed with a very strong bipartisan support in the Senate, went down to the Ways and Means, where it became part of the end game last session. And maybe we can just have Elizabeth, if you'll just take us quickly
sure.
through the Dash 9.
With the Dash 9 amendment, this basically is the one from last session, which is the personal income tax exemption for 7 years for a senior executive manager of a venture capitalist firm that initially has $75 million in available capital to invest and invests in at least $2 million in Oregon businesses in the previous 12 months. It then also allows an income tax exemption for 7 years for university senior research faculty who conduct new lines of research after January 1st, 2000. And have stable funding of at least $200,000 per year, and for which commercial applications exist in the research area of nanotechnology and multi-scale materials. Basically, it's restricting the personal income tax exemption to one qualified executive manager per firm who has the authority to make fundamental business decisions for the venture capitalist firm. It requires the qualified university faculty to make fundamental decisions about the direction of the research conducted at the university. It outlines then the elements of the initial and annual application process by which the taxpayer will apply to the Economic Community Development Department for certification for the income tax exemption. And then it puts a solid restriction in there to the department to not issue initial certifications for more than 30 research faculty and 15 executive of venture capitalists. And then there's also an annual reapplication each year. So a qualified venture capitalist firm must again have at least $75 million in unobligated venture capital and have invested at least $2 million or more in one or more businesses in the state in the previous 12 months and have an ongoing concern for the applicant. And for the annual reapplication, the senior researcher must demonstrate, again, having at least $200,000 in stable annual funding for their research. And it defines the element of income that are taxed and that are exempt from the tax. And then it limits the personal income tax exemption to the 7 years. And then it compels the Economic Community Development Department to prepare reports detailing the effectiveness of the income tax exemption for 2007 and 2009 Oregon legislatures. And the income tax exemption applies to initial certifications filed with Economic and Community Development Department beginning December 1st, 2006. So basically on the revenue impact, you do have an impact this biennium, and that's just because it's beginning here in 2006. So I assume that initially that you just have one additional executive of the venture capitalist firm and one senior researcher every year that is coming on. But then I assume that those ones initially, once they come on, they're going to continue their research and have new research each year. So basically it's starting out at a reduction of $42,840 by the 708 fiscal year. It's a reduction of $108,745, and then it grows up to 2011-12 fiscal year to $333,757.
And that would be the foregone income tax.
That's right.
For both annual additions to venture capitalists coming into the state, as well as university senior
researchers.
Faculty.
That's right. That's all it is.
And this is what Senator Deckert explains as the if-then theory that I guess we did have a revenue loss of revenue last session, and that's why this was referred in part to the Ways and Means process. And my question is, it's going to be a hard one for you, and that is between the 2003 session and the 2005 session, have any idea how many new venture capital firms have moved to town?
Chairman Butler, no, I don't know. We can look into that.
Okay. I think you'll find that the number is very close to zero.
Okay.
That Oregon, without having something to attract the venture capitalists away from Wall Street, away from Lancaster Boulevard, we have not had new venture capital firms rushing to break down our doors in Oregon that meet the criteria that we've got here, the high-tech venture capital firms. And Representative Riley, did you have a comment?
Well, I do have a comment, and that is, I do know that I have some friends who actually are working on some biotech areas, and they are getting venture capital in this state.
And you know where that's coming from?
Does it really matter?
It does.
Okay,
it does under this bill. It brings the venture capitalists to Oregon.
Well, at any rate, they are getting venture capital, and this is a spinoff company from OHSU.
And that's what we were concerned about, was that if we could bring venture capitalists to Broadway or downtown Portland in the state of Oregon, that perhaps rather than having these firms take that risk from out of state and having no income derived into the state of Oregon. See, they don't pay any income tax just because they loan money or advance those kinds of funds. Yes, Representative Riley?
Maybe I'm confused a little bit. I seem to get confused on these things. Most of the income that's derived from these in the companies that are doing the research, isn't that where, I mean, the venture capital coming from somewhere else seems great to me. I don't quite understand.
Yeah, this does not exempt the firms that they're assisting. What it tries to do, it tries to reach out. This particular bill, 362, attempted to reach out and bring a venture capital firm to Oregon. We didn't have any new venture capital. I don't know if there's venture capital. I guess you could look in the phone book and find out if there's any venture capital firms that are really located in the state of Oregon. They might have contact numbers in the state of Oregon, but the idea was to attempt to offer the if-then theory. If you offer them an opportunity to come to Oregon and make one of the venture capitalists who is already investing, who has a great deal of freeboard to invest in the market, and they will set up their offices. This is the pyramid approach. Pyramid approach is, if I can bring in the top of the pyramid, then they'll bring their staff with them, and they'll bring their offices with them. With that, by bringing the top person to the state of Oregon, then what you have is a venture capital firm in downtown Portland or downtown, fill in the name of the city in Oregon, and that way then other firms who have these opportunities or desire for the opportunity to seek out venture capital for their better mousetraps will have a firm in Oregon that they can go to, as opposed to going to Wall Street and trying to get Representative Senator Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for allowing me to participate in the committee discussion. I have to admit that I read this very hastily while I was listening to the legislative revenue staff present the oral case. Three things come to my mind. One of them is a conversation that we had when we dealt with this bill last year in the House, and I had the opportunity to participate. And that was the question of, do we have too much money looking for too few good ideas right now? And I think the question that was asked about the presence of venture capital firms in this state and what their capacity to fund new ideas is would be a very important piece of information to have with respect to these amendments. My second comment is, I have had the opportunity this session to sit on the subcommittee of Ways and Means reviewing Oregon Economic and Community Development's budget. I think that is an agency that is struggling right now, and I think others would agree with me that they have had a very hard time prioritizing technology, venture capital, and what role those initiatives should play in Oregon economic and community development as it is currently structured. I'm a little troubled by sub 1 in section 5 that has Oregon economic and community development doing the initial certification for this program. I understand right now that in the high-tech area at OECDD, and if you'll excuse me for using the acronym, they're struggling to get a 16, I'm using this as an example because I was told firsthand that this situation recently existed, a one-page scope, a $1,600 fiscal impact, and it took a 20-page contract and months to get the work done. My understanding of part of why venture capital works is that it is nimble, it is responsive, and I don't see anything in Oregon economic and community development right now, respectfully, that meets those criteria. And last but not least, I'm concerned about Section 5 sub B that talks about the applicant affiliated with a university. And I know from my work at the Oregon Health and Sciences University that there has been a great deal of trouble prioritizing among their many pressing needs which department they allow to go out to do fundraising. The School of Medicine may have an initiative, and they would ask everyone else to step back while those donors were contacted, and the full might of the university would turn to that particular project in the School of Medicine. And I'm making this up, but I'm just using it as an illustrative. Then maybe the next year, the prime issue that needed to have money raised for it would be Dornbecker. And the discipline was enforced to have all of the other schools step back and allow the Dornbecker need to be the development object of that fundraising initiative. What concerns me is that if the applicants are affiliated with universities and they are allowed to apply directly to OECDD, what control does the university have over prioritizing who in their teaching faculty might or clinical faculty might be subject to this kind of a tax accommodation when others perhaps pursuing the same work were not? And while I am very, very supportive of the idea of having available venture capital firms in this state, I do have some concerns about these particular amendments as they would be incorporated into Senate Bill 31. And I just offer those for your consideration, and I will readily admit I did a fast read through this bill as the staff was speaking.
Thank you, Senator Johnson. I appreciate your observations, and I recognize that 2 years have gone by, and OECD is in a different state than where they were at this time 2 years ago. The concern I have is that when we do have OECD involved in the initial certification, that there's got to be a process on board, and if they can't come out and assist in qualifying the executive venture capitalists, up to 15 of them, that are making applications that are saying we meet all of the criteria. We have $75 million on freeboard of capital. We've invested at least $2 million in the state of Oregon this past year. We're applying for qualification. I would guess that the director would have firsthand knowledge from a member of the faculty before very long, I would think. Senator Morse.
Mr. Chairman, again, thank you for the opportunity to be a part of your discussion. Possibly a consideration in order to keep this concept alive would be to consider the Treasurer's Department and putting the responsibility into the Oregon Growth Account Board, which already deals with the venture capital. They're immersed in that, and that's their portfolio. That might be a logical place to have this reside, as opposed to the OECD. That's, you know, this is just not their bailiwick.
I appreciate that. And why don't we continue to work on the Representative Hass?
Thank you. I have two concerns here. First, there are venture capital firms in Oregon. Now, if this were to pass, does that mean they now would qualify for this? And the other question, I guess, or comment question is, what evidence are we basing this on? Have we seen it in other states where a tax break for executives of these firms compels them to relocate or expand? Or do we just have a hunch that this might work? I mean, do we have any data to base this policy on? And I got to tell you, based in part on the growth account, which I think has returned $0 in its 6 or 8 years, I'm just not so sure that venture capital operations and government work together. I just don't think the people that play that high-risk, high-reward game base any of their decisions upon what government does. It's just there's just not a lot of evidence that ties those two operations together.
Thank you for that observation, Representative Hass. And I think there are some questions there as to who would qualify in coming to Oregon with these kinds of things versus those that may already be here. I think the original criteria was set up based upon who was here right now and who could qualify for the current. Originally, the high bar that they were jumping through, the executives, you had to have and it was my recollection that they had to have super credentials in order to even qualify to come to Oregon. But I don't see that as part of the credentialing here. And this particular -9 amendment. But I will say this: there are folks that do track these kinds of things. Unfortunately. Pat Scruggs is one of the people that have some of the information about this bill, and she's out of town right now, but one of the things that her comment was that Oregon is, after we presented some of these ideas last session, other states went ahead and did some of these things and have been successful in attracting new venture capital firms to their states, and obviously if you have the money in the state on Main Street in your downtown area, then you'll have greater opportunity to bring those folks to the businesses that need that exposure to the venture capital. So we will continue to work, and we need to get Senator Deckert back on board. I think this was last minute. We said we would go ahead and bring this idea back forward again because it was an excellent idea. Oregon has not added any new venture capital firms that I'm aware of. Of course, I'm not in the venture capital business in downtown Portland, but while there are firms that are still getting venture capital out there, the question is it coming from Los Angeles? Is it coming from Wall Street and back east? So, and could they do a better job of receiving it in Oregon? Further questions of
Mr. Chair, before
Senator.
The committee continues its deliberations, we came to aggressively advocate for the Dash 8s. May we be excused while you work on these?
Absolutely. I appreciate it because you were both involved in the original Dash 9 in one fashion or another. I want to give you an opportunity to also comment on that.
Thank you very much.
Chair, members of the committee.
How about the Dash 10?
We've got other bills.
Yeah, where do you stand on the Dash 10?
Colleagues, we'll continue to work on Senate Bill 31 with the various iterations, and we'll invite Senator Decker to come and speak on behalf of his former Senate Bill 362. With that, we will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 31, and we will go to a public hearing on House Bill 2775. Ms. Beth?
Okay. Chairman Butler, with House Bill 2775, this is again the same bill as your Senate Bill 996. When you have the Dash 2 amendment. So your Dash 2 amendment is eliminating the blank in the bill, and then it is also extending the sunset on the affordable housing tax credit out, again, 10 years from December 31st, 2009 to December 31st, 2019. And again, it's setting the annual cap amount for the affordable housing tax credit at $11 million. Okay, now this bill originally had a referral to the Joint Ways and Means. You'll need to resend that, and then if you wanted to go to the House budget, so just so everyone's clear, that's what we currently have on this bill.
But we've got 996 completed with the sunset amendment.
That's right.
And this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means,
right,
which would either have to be rescinded or referred over to the House budget committee.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to struggle with that for just a minute. Do we have anyone signed up on this bill?
She can speak to why she wants the bill.
This came at the request of the Committee on Elections and Rules. Yes, please. Okay, thank you.
Chair Butler, members of the committee, Danelle Romaine for the record, representing the Housing Alliance. This is just another vehicle for the affordable housing tax credit, which we started in the House, and it does have a subsequent to the House Budget Committee, and we're happy with whatever you choose to do with it.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I have no... are there questions for Danelle? I have no preference one way or the other. We would have to amend this... with the Dash 2 amendments, and then we would have to have a motion to make the referral from the Ways and Means to the budget, to the House budget.
You don't need both. Right?
You wouldn't need both. This leaves one of them alive in another committee, yeah, is what it does. And the Senate bill looks like to me that it's got life at this particular point.
Right.
So with that, I'm going to just go ahead, unless there's other convincing evidence to the contrary, I'm going to close public hearing on 2775, House Bill 2775. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2514.
Okay, Chairman Butler, with House Bill 2514, we've heard this before, but this is one of your rural medical provider tax credit bills, and this one adds the licensed psychologist to the list of rural medical providers who can qualify then for that rural medical provider tax credit. It allows the Office of Rural Health to identify the rural area for which the psychologist can provide psychological services which qualifies the provider for the tax credit. It provides the Office of Rural Health the authority to establish criteria for certifying individuals as eligible for this tax credit. Applies to tax years beginning on or after January 1st, 2009. As we originally discussed about this particular bill, just the way it is, does not restrict psychologists in the statute itself to, like, frontier counties or anything. It's just saying that it gives the Office of Rural Health the ability to establish criteria, so you don't really know what that criteria would be. So with House Bill 2514, you have a revenue loss beginning in 2008-09, and basically roughly $267,000. It goes up to about $667,000 in 2009-10 fiscal year, and it's roughly that same amount each year afterwards. It's starting with a base of about 129 psychologists in rural areas.
129?
Correct.
In rural areas.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Questions of staff? No amendments to House Bill 25.
But we had I think a dash one. It was this was the pharmacist, I think. I guess I've got the dash two. Yeah.
I think that there were proposals of several to crawl on. I don't think that Damiana is prepared for any of those amendments. So, colleagues, we're in a work session on House Bill 2514.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
I'd like to move House Bill 2514 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
The motion is to move House Bill 2514 with a due pass motion to the House floor. Is there discussion on the motion?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Hass is recognized.
I think this is a good idea, but it's emblematic of what I think is the sort of the tax break problem we have, in that there is no system or analysis to prioritize why this is better than a tax credit for someone else, or why this is a higher priority than benefits for the Oregon Health Plan, which at least provide for matching money from the federal government that will also help some of these very same populations. And I think it points to the need of trying to have some sort of rational analysis of our tax expenditures, so that it's easier for us to prioritize which one of some competing good ideas make the most sense on the limited budget.
Thank you, Representative Hass. And I'm hopeful that as a result of some work that the Office of Rural Health is doing on some related bills, that we're going to be able to have some kind of a measuring device to be able to stick into these, and we'll work on that. It's part of our work plan for the interim that we're going to recommend to House leadership, that we come back and actually start to work not just the issue of the rural tax credits, but all kinds of credits and other kinds of tax issues that we've got out there, of the credits and so forth. So I appreciate that comment. Further discussion, Representative Boquist.
Hey, Mr. Chair, just for the record, during that interim, I'm very interested in addressing the overall rural health system as it involves taxation.
Thank you very much. And this, we've had several credits and several discussions about additional folks included in this. So those are issues that will come forward in the interim. And again, that should be part of our work plan as we examine the efficacy of credits all around. The clerk will call a roll on the motion to pass House Bill 2514 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Boquist.
Yes.
Representative Esquivel.
Aye.
Representative Felicio.
Aye.
Representative Kahl.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Yes.
Representative Riley.
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger.
Aye.
Vice Chair Hass.
No.
And Chair Butler.
Butler votes aye. With that, House Bill 2514, having received the constitutional majority, is passed to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. And all carried out to the floor. And with that, colleagues, we'll close in time to make it to the House floor. We'll close the work session on 2514 and close revenue for today. Thank you very much.